Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to is recorded at DEF CON 4 at the Monte Carlo Casino and Resort, freshly built in 1996. Copyright, all right reserves, except permission is expressly granted for non-profit educational use. Now sit back and relax. If you have any questions, please contact me at dtangent@defcon.org or visit our website, www.defcon.org. Thank you, and kick back and relax.
Well, just to start off, let me ask everyone a question here. By a show of hands, how many people hack or freak for the money? Okay. How many people? I've got two quarters in my pocket. Okay, how many people hack for the recognition? Just to say, hey, I'm cool, I can hack, or power trip. Honest show of hands. Okay, how many people do it just because they want to learn how the systems work and they want to figure out what makes something tick?
How about for the women?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the power trip part. Well, I've been back in 83, I read a file by Fuck Dage 04 on Bell Hardware, and I got it on an Apple disc. Some guy just gave me and said, here, read this, you might find it interesting. And I started reading it. I read the file 18 ways to Sunday, read the entire disc, went out and made a Lyman's test set off an old phone, cut off the end, put alligator clips on it, went out to the side of my house and hooked it up and said, hey, wow, this is pretty cool. Problem was that I didn't have a computer with a modem, and I didn't have any contacts and any way of getting in. And learning things in the hacking community is like getting credit. Unless you have credit, you can't get credit. Unless you know something in the hacker community, you can't learn something else. Everyone has to pull themselves up by their shoestrings, and they have to reinvent the wheel 18 times. One of the things that the institution is set up to do is to create a sense of community that was prevalent back in the mid-80s, where it was you could get on a comp and someone could tell you anything, didn't know you from Adam. It's not like, hey, what wares do you have to trade? It's, you know, this, hey, I know how to do this, or I find out something cool or new, and instead of trying to be elitist and say, you can't know this stuff because, you know, I want to know it, I'm way cool because I know it, it's just, here, this is awesome, I found this out, check this out, look what I can do. And we want to create a loose fraternity or association where you can say, hey, I know this person's in the institution, they're worthwhile. One of the other things, the issues that come up is the responsibility of doing certain things with the information. There are people out there that wear black hats. There's enough people, I'm sure, at the con that have a ton of fun going out and just taking down machines just for the hell of it, which I think is absolute crap. There should be no reason why you should go out and take down a machine. I love the way the network's set up, and, well, no, not the way it's set up, but I love the way it works. I want to figure out as much as I can about how it's running. And people that go out and just take down machines for the hell of it, denial of service. There's so many people out there that think that hacking is the, you know, denial of service or just, you know, reading mail or hacking fake mail, and that's just crap. Most of us that are real hackers want to learn how the system works, and we want to learn as much as we can. And instead of all of us going out and reinventing the wheel and learning the same thing over and over and over, those of us who know a certain topic or a certain idea can teach the others. And we need to have if you learn it completely on your own, there's a lot to be said for that because you have a deeper understanding. But I know that if I want to learn something, I'm going to find everything out about it as I can, but I don't have to reinvent the wheel and start from complete scratch trying to find stuff out. And if we can create some kind of association where all of us, the whole community, can get together and say, hey, we're going to be responsible. We're going to keep from giving hackers a bad name, tying into Hack the Lies. If we can keep everyone to make everyone act responsible, we can feed on each other. And two hackers side by side working together are twice as good as each of them on their own. And I think that's one of the things we just need to do is start sharing the information, but we also need to moderate and make sure that it's going to be passed out responsibly, because we don't want the people in the black hats or the people that are going to go out and use it to power trip to take advantage of that. But we're starting to organize this right now. We've had the idea for a while. We just haven't done anything about it because we didn't know if the time was right. We think that there's enough going on now that we can start organizing this. We have a right now we've got a alias set up on command.com.inter.net, the institution. So you just want to email us, we'll start a list up, and we're going to have a web page and so forth. We just threw this together about 2 weeks ago. We told DT that we want to get up and start talking about it and spread it out. So it's going to take a while to grow. It's not going to happen right away, but I think there's enough interest out there. A lot of us old school hackers that have been around for a long time want to say, you know, want to keep the sense of community and make it grow like we used to have. So one of the other things we want to do is take suggestions like the guys are doing before about ideas, questions, or suggestions on what we can do, comments, how you feel. For the most part, hopefully productive. So at that point, I think we'll open it up. Anybody have any questions on what we're doing? Okay.
It almost sounds, like you're making like another elitist group that's out there that you'd like to have, what are your purposes to get away from? How do you avoid getting into that?
Well, basically, we've put together a series of tenets that say this is what we believe. And we want the most important thing, like I was talking about, is getting the information out to responsible people. We don't want to give all the information out to anybody. We don't want to be elitist. We want to make sure that all the things that we know, if we're not going to tell somebody how to hack 1A and give that out to a guy that's going to take down, you know, half a city. And that's what we want to make sure that we don't do, because then it just gives us all a bad name. We want to make sure that we have responsible people. Most of us, the overwhelming majority of hackers, want to do it just for the fun of it and to learn how the stuff works. So we're not trying to set up an elitist group. We just want to say that here, if you want to be in the institution, just agree the fact that, hey, I don't think I should crash a machine. I'm not going to give out information. I'm not going to narc. You know, use PGP, things like that, that are really simple stuff. It's common that everybody that has an ounce of gray matter agrees with. But it's just that, yeah, I'm willing to agree with that. And now, hey, we can pass that out and we could share the information. But we just want to make sure that the information goes out and it's widespread. We don't want it to be a clique of 20 people. We don't want it to be 40 people. We want it to be every hacker that we can get. We also want to get all the new breed, all the new people that are coming in. We can teach them how to hack responsibly. Instead of some guy that's on a power trip, somebody, little kid that's 12 years old says, hey, I want to learn how to hack. You've got some guy over here that's power tripping and likes to take down systems for the fun of it. And they go out and say, here, you know, I'll show you how to hack. And he shows them all the wrong things and doesn't give them any kind of hacker ethic or anything. So we want it to be as wide as possible. We just want to make sure that the responsible people get the information. So, right here, you were saying. That is something that has a valid point. It's going to take a lot of work to do that, because obviously if someone goes in and crashes it, you're going to have to spend a lot of time putting it back up. And that is a point where you could learn, you know, your training wheels are this network or something over on the side here, so you don't go out and crash any of the real machines out on the net. So I know most of us probably, I started out on Telenet way back when, and everyone remembers all the Citicorp and all those machines that are out there, and I'm sure that we messed up quite a few machines when we were learning how to do stuff, but that was one of the things that we just need to, if we share more information, if we say, here, this is how you do it, it will go a lot farther and there will be less machines that will be taken down. In the back? Well, to a certain extent, there are a lot of script kiddies out there that will hang around. They don't really have a clue what's going on. And that's one of the things that we want to try to moderate to an extent, is if someone wants to really learn how to hack, we want to be open. We want everybody and their brother to come in and be a part of this, because the more people we have, the more powerful it is as a whole. The symbiosis that we get with 2,000 people as opposed to 20 people, it's amazing how much information we have. We've got a list or a group where we can say, hey, I want to find out, how does a 5E work? And we can find somebody that knows 5Es, and they say, here, this is how it works. So if you happen to find one, this is what not to do, or this is what to do so you don't shut down half the city. And that's what we want to try to propagate. Not that anybody knows anything about 5Es or 1As or anything like that.
Let me interject here. The intent of the group is not to disseminate information that is easily exploitable. It's information that this is how the system works. If you want to try to exploit the system, that's your own decision and completely disassociated from the institution itself. Okay? We're not necessarily looking for somebody to come up to us and say, here is a script. This is the script that will allow you to get root on this system. We're not interested at all, really, in that kind of information. What we want is, this is how the system works, the way the processing works on the system, how the hardware is set up, even to that extent. I'm not necessarily wanting or interested in direct exploits, or especially illegal information. It's not part of this.
Right. We can't officially say we're going to...
This is a how things works kind of idea.
And
it's conglomerate.
How many people get a script and that they find out there that it bugs me 18 ways to Sunday, I get a script, and the first thing I try to do most of the time before I run it is try to figure out how it works and to solve the problem. And if we get the people that write it to start passing out the information, says this is how it works or this is why it works, then that makes a hell of a lot more sense and we all understand it a lot better. But we're definitely, the institution's not set up just to teach people how to, you know, hack root. You know, anybody and their brother can find enough scripts out there to do that. We want to teach enough responsible information dissemination so that we can make the community grow. So there were some other questions? Yeah.
When I've written articles on board report, I find it, as always, just trying to understand the world around it.
Mm-hmm.
Leave it at that.
Right. Well, and that's, I mean, I think we all just want to explore. There's a challenge. It's fun to get into. Yeah, it's fun to get root. But, you know, after your first, you know, 50 or so roots, well, after that, it kind of loses the excitement just for that. It's not as much of a rush anymore. It's just, hey, well, let me find out how this works. So, any other questions or comments?
One of the things that I remember, I'm also an old school hacker. I go way back to 1979 when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the ethics that I got were obtained not because I was told to have that ethic, it was because I had a certain respect for the systems that I was working with. I feel, I commend your efforts, but I feel like a lot of the young kids now starting to come in don't have the same respect because their parents bought their computer at Kmart or wherever. You know, they have America Online. They really do not understand the technology that's involved.
Well, And I agree, just like with the guy in the back, what he said about the fact that there used to be a barrier and the fact that when we had to go out and we had to really work our butts off in order to get into any of this stuff and figure out how it works.
Right, but my question to you is, and I kind of have a follow-up comment to this as well, that might be a suggestion, but how do you keep, where do you draw the demarcation between some cookbook kid that's just trying to expand his menu of what he can break into, and somebody who really is interested and really wants to get into the bare bones level of what's going on?
We won't produce cookbooks. We're not going to have a script for getting root or a script for...
I understand that, but sometimes, even if you code information in such a way that you have to have a certain amount of knowledge to use it, cookbook kids can get at it. I know personally of some cookbook-type kids who have gotten a hold of AT&T 5ESS net and have figured out stuff from them and have then used that information to the detriment of somebody else.
I have to disagree that that's a cookbook. That's not a cookbook.
Well,
if they've read the manuals and truly understand the system, I would just hope that they would respect what they're playing with.
Well,
part of the institution isn't really to disseminate manuals such as this is the manual for the HP 700. Okay, it's more to the point where the interaction between the operating system and the hardware works this way. And if they find out through their own research that I can do these three coding sequences and get access or produce this desired output, then such is life for that. I understand your issue with like the mange of people on internet. I really do. And I think there's a lot of groups that are going to just jump on because they say, hey, this is free information.
Well, the other thing is if the entire underground, quote-unquote underground community, and with the Hack Alive, one of the things we're trying to do is not make it as underground, but if the entire underground community gets together and frowns upon some of the stuff that goes around collectively, if we all say it's crap to take down a system just for the fun of it, and there's so much more that you can learn by being a productive part of it, then I think there's going to be fewer people out there. And I think, yeah, there is a barrier that has gone away where everybody and their brother can get on the internet now, but I would rather give out more information to more people, but also if they hang out with people that respect it, they're going to pick that up. And I certainly agree that understanding the system by doing it yourself, you get a greater respect for the hardware and how the technology works.
I have a comment that might be a solution for this.
Okay.
One phenomenon that I've seen going around on the country that I've never heard anybody talk about at DEF CON is kind of a resurgence of small clubs. People who, for instance, the WAP was the first one of any significance, but I know of many others who know about four or five that I know of that have cropped up in the last year and a half.
Right.
They've rented office or industrial space somewhere. They've set up small networks, and they're a small group of 5 to 20 people. Maybe the solution isn't to have one big organization, but a bunch of little organizations that talk to each other. Like a 2600 meeting, you know who the clowns are.
Right.
And the clown and the cool people tend to separate, and people that really care, that really are interested, are talking about stuff that really matters.
Right, agreed. I agree 100%. And you could have both from the standpoint that, again, the institution is supposed to be a loose organization. It's not supposed to be any type of worldwide group. We're not, because there are so many conspiracy things that would be going around. That's not what we're trying to do at all. What we're trying to do is just make sure that for the people that want to learn how to do something, we can give them a place to start. We can give them a place to start learning. We can start perpetrating the hacker ethic. And the small groups, all of those people that are in the small groups can be part of the institution from the standpoint that, hey, and they can say, here, I need to find out how to do this. Or we were playing around with this the other night at our 2600 meeting, and we couldn't figure out how to do this. Does anyone know how this works? And those of us that are in the institution are going to say, hey, I'm willing to give up the information because I know how to do it. But I agree, it's the small groups, it's people getting together, and that's how anybody really learns anything. But it's the interaction. I mean, you can't learn that much completely on your own. You can learn a lot, but there's a point where you can say, you know, I only have so much time in the day. And I know that I've got enough going on in my life that, I'm not in high school anymore. I can't spend 17 hours a day hacking and learning how to do this stuff. Right, you can't read everything out of a textbook, and everyone has to learn. That's why we're propagating the understanding as well. But any of us that read Mentor's Guide to, Basic Guide to Hacking, where it was, way back when, you get on Telenet, this is the number to call, this is where you get started. And I remember reading that, and that was one of the files that I found when I was looking so hard. I was like, hey, wow, now I've got some information because somebody gave me a point to start. And then after that, there's so many files out there that, anyone can go out and read G-files. It's one of the things we can do is create a library. I mean, there's a lot of libraries out there that have the information already there, and you can go play with it from there. But it's the understanding and when people want information coming to it. I mean, I know that I would want to understand it. The true hacker wants to understand how it works, not just say, how do I get root? So I think that's when what we want to propagate is, here, we'll give you some information, but you really need to understand how it works, and that's the whole idea behind it. So I think we're pretty close to running out of time here. I know we've run over. Any other questions or comments? the institution or institution at command.com.enter.net.
That's going to break some of your old DNS lookups, so make sure you upgrade.
That's Voyager's site, so we'll be getting lists and web pages sites started, et cetera. So we're just getting the early stages. That's why we want to get input from people. The support, it's going to start slow. There's no question. It's not going to happen overnight. But the more people that get involved, the more people are going to want to get involved, and it's just going to grow exponentially. So is there another question in the back over here? Anyone? All right. Well, thanks for your ears, and hopefully we'll get it going and create the sense of community that we had a while ago. I mean, I miss it. There's so much elitism around. That's one of the other things. We just want to stomp elitism down because I hate that. How many people say, you're not elite enough for me to answer the question, or you come in, somebody new comes into Pound Hack, if they can get in, period, and says, I want to learn how to do this, or does anyone know about this? And they get booted just because they asked a question. And that's not the type of attitude that should be prevalent at all, especially amongst hackers. So, all right. Thanks much. Appreciate it. And email us.
Okay, if you'd previously spotted a Fed and we didn't get you your shirt, you know who you are. Yeah, right. You can get your shirt as soon as I'm done doing this. And then what do we have? We have three shirts left, three spotted and three IM. And I know some of you guys have previously spotted Fed, so feel free to point them out again and win shirts and stuff. Someone else has captured another machine, so the Team Lamer has gotten two machines now. And so it looks like they're going to be on track to winning, unless the other cron jobs boot them or people come up with something new. New and nasty. This next speaker was here last year from Index Publishing. He writes all types of books on how to remain anonymous, how to find information. And he randomly selected a celebrity and just went and found out how much information he could pull on them just to see how much info is legally available, no hacking necessary, no laws broken. And it's quite impressive how many docs you can pull on someone with just, you know, some spare time and like $30 and a fax machine. So, did you want to just stand down there, or are you going to stand up here?
Yeah, I'll come up there. I need to use the overhead.
Okay, and you want someone just to swap the overhead slides?
Yeah, if somebody could do that.
Okay, great. So if you could tell everybody in the other room that the speech is about to start, that would be great. And it's John Q. Newman.
Well, how are you guys doing today? Men and women of DEF CON, intrepid you are. But, before I start, first I want to explain what I'm not. I'm not a great computer expert. I've talked to a lot of you guys, and I want to make that clear. Real technical questions on, you know, about equipment and telecommunications and this kind of stuff, I'm not the guy who can answer that. What I can show you, and what I am going to show you, is one, how files are built from small, discrete bits of information given for one purpose about ourselves, and number two, how you can prevent this very thing from happening to you as an individual, reclaim some of your privacy. I think a lot of you are going to be quite surprised at just who collects information, who sells it, and who and where it's available. The dangerous thing is in the main, there is no laws regulating the collection, the creation, and resale of dossiers or databases containing very sensitive personal information. For example, if I would say to any of you, walk up to you not knowing me from Adam, and say, look, I want you to give me your name, your address, telephone number, social security number, where you work, what your approximate income level is, whether or not you own a car, and if you do, do you own it, really own it, or does the bank own it, as it is the case for most of us, you tell me where to go. And rightly so, you'd be, well, I don't know you, why would I tell you this? However, on a daily basis, you provide this information to strangers. Last time you wrote a check and provided somebody with your driver's license, you gave them not only all of your personal identifiers, you also gave them your financial identifiers. You gave a total stranger your bank account number plus all of your personal identifiers. If that person wants to take your life down, they can do it. You don't even know them. You gave it to some $5 an hour clerk. When you check into a hotel and show ID, if the guy has got malicious intent, he could just write down a few numbers and have total access into your lives. The other thing that has happened is that private corporations have realized the value of their databases, such as when you all got, practically everybody here owns a computer, anybody who doesn't, I'll be surprised, and you all get those nice warranty cards to get, as one guy said, a free mouse pad or whatever, and they ask all sorts of information, do you rent, do you own, what's your approximate income level, all this stuff, and you think it's just because these guys want to service you better. Well, yeah, it is and it isn't. Because that card you send in doesn't go first to the manufacturer. It goes to a fulfillment company who then takes that data and then cross-matches it with other data to build up a very valuable file on you, which can then be resold. So I have a number of books out. One deals with how to prevent this from happening to you. The other deals with how to go find out information about other people. And I was kind of wondering, what should I start off with first? And I think we'll start out with how to build a file on somebody else. And then we'll look at how you can stop it from happening to you. A couple of months ago, I was watching a movie of the week called Home Song. And it was a gripping tale of a man who has an affair with a pizza delivery woman the night before he graduates at the frat house. He makes the woman pregnant. She doesn't tell him. He gets married the next day. She stays in the little town in Texas where they went to school. 20 years later, this woman takes a job with an unnamed major software company in Seattle. Wonder who that could be. And guess what? Her son enrolls at the very school where the daddy is the principal. Well, you know, movie of the week, it's tear-jerking, all this kind of stuff, right? Movie comes to an end, and I'm like, you know, the actress who played the lead role, she was kind of cute. I wonder what her name was. Well, her name was Deborah Raffin. And I said, you know, I'm going to be talking at DEF CON. Why don't I use her as an example? So, hey, does this mic walk and talk, or am I going to lose this if I go over here? Can I walk with it? Huh? Carry the podium? Okay. Hey, can somebody, Simon, or can you, yeah, can I give you, tell you what to put up on there? Okay. In any case, well, we'll get to that in a minute then. In any case, the woman's name was Deborah Raffin. Now, a few of you might recognize her name, but she's not like Madonna. And I figured, you know, why do Madonna? Everybody's seen all of Madonna. I mean, God, there was sex. I mean, what is there about Madonna to learn? You know, I mean, a file on Madonna is kind of redundant. Or Oprah, I mean, the same thing. I don't know if anybody wants to see Oprah that much, but, you know. So the thing is that I said, okay, this is a woman. She is a public figure. First off, this is what I want to tell you. Public figures do not have a right of privacy. Okay, when you get the big bucks, you're Michael Jordan getting the $30 million a year, you're Bill Cosby getting $25 million a year, David Letterman getting only a paltry $17 million a year, then you give up your right of privacy because you're getting the big bucks because all of us little guys out here are going, oh, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, oh, it's David Letterman. We buy the tickets, he makes the big bucks, he lives in Beverly Hills in the mansion. Okay, so public figures give up their right of privacy in order to make the big bucks. So when it's a public figure, like you're going to see in a minute, she cannot come and sue me or sue us for showing this information about her because as a public figure, she is deemed not to have a right of privacy. Now, you and I are not public figures. If I picked one of you at random out of the audience and did this, then you could sue the hell out of me. Yes.
What's the dollar value or the point where you
a public figure? It's not really a dollar value per se. When these cases have gone to court, what it comes down to is that does the personality or celebrity rely on the fact that their image or name is common currency in public in whatever realm of business they're in, be it entertainment, be they a business executive at the top of a corporation, if they rely on the fact that they their face, their likeness, their name is commonly known to earn a living, that basically makes them a public figure. That's the Rubicon. It's kind of like, remember, was it 6 or 7 years ago when a USA Today reporter had found out Arthur Ashe had AIDS, remember? And there was a lot of debate whether or not he should have broken the story because Arthur Ashe is no longer a big-time tennis star, everything else. And the USA Today reporter basically said, I'll sit on the story for a couple of days, but then I will release it so you have a chance to either comment about it now or it'll go out into the clear without your feedback on it. Problem was, Arthur Ashe could have no basis to file a lawsuit against USA because as a tennis pro, even though it had been many years before, he had become a public figure. So even though now he was in the golden years in retirement, so to speak, he had given up his right of privacy by becoming that public figure. You could say another definition of a public figure is you can be a top electrical engineer and make $1 million a year. Nobody in public really knows who you are because that job does not depend on the general public having an idea of who you are. So you're not a public figure. However, if you're a singing star who makes $1 million a year, it's prima facie case that the reason you make the money, let's face it, if Arnold Schwarzenegger walked in here, even as jaded as this crowd is, we'd all look and go, hey, what's, you know, the Terminator doing here, right? You know? Okay, that's because the Terminator's a public figure. In any case, whilst they're getting those ready, let's talk about if you want to do an investigation, where do you start? First of all, you take a look at what information do you know. The most important things is to get what are called primary identifiers. Primary identifiers are things that don't change. You're looking at me. What does everybody agree on? Now, I know you all think I'm a handsome, studly kind of guy, but maybe there's a few people who don't agree on that. However, I'm willing to bet all of you agree I'm a black man. Okay. That's a primary identifier. The man is black. Yeah, I'm sure. Okay? That's a primary identifier. Race is a primary identifier. Sex is a primary identifier. Now, you may start laughing. I know there are a few people might be in that gray area you can't quite figure out. However, sex in general is a primary identifier. And I'll give an example. I recently did a search on a man who had run a company here locally. They went under and decided they weren't going to pay their employees. And the guy had unlisted number, all this stuff. Well, part of the problem was when I first started to try to do to find the data trail on this guy, is his name is Gabrielle. Well, you know, most people assume Gabrielle is a woman's name, when in reality, was a man. So all the databases I was searching kept coming back, no, there is no Gabrielle. I won't give his last name, but there is no Gabrielle. When in reality, if I'd put in, I'm looking for a male, then the information would have popped up. Okay, so was looking at things like race, sex, full legal name. For example, the actor Michael Keaton, his real name is Michael Douglas. Why does he go by Michael Keaton? Because the Screen Actors Guild, the Actors Union, only allows one person to be registered in the union at a time under a given name. Michael Douglas got there first. So if he didn't want to be Michael Douglas or Michael A. Douglas or something like that, then he figured he'd just change his name for that purpose so that people would not always confuse him with the real Michael Douglas that they wanted. So Michael Keaton, if you're doing a data search, willing to bet you most of Michael Keaton's legal records, like driver's license, voter registration, all that kind of stuff, is probably as Michael Douglas. So if you look for a Michael Keaton, you probably won't find too much. This is an important thing to remember when you're backgrounding, especially an entertainment or a singing celebrity, or even like a writer like, say, Tom Clancy or something. Not that Clancy is using anything but his own name. Very frequently, performers have to alter their name, or they do alter it, the so-called stage name, one, to get a little bit of privacy, and two, because in the union that they're a member of, there may already be somebody else there with their name. So you must absolutely find out the actual legal name the person was born under. Now you may ask, where can I find this out at? Well, you can find it out a lot of places. One invaluable resource is the Who's Who's directories. There's not just one, there's hundreds of them. There's Who's Who in science and engineering, Who's Who in movie and television, Who's Who in music. There's hundreds of these directories. And there are other directories that do the same thing. There are also pages on the web where people have a particular interest in a certain celebrity. And these people will have done research to find out where they were really born, what their real name is, this kind of stuff. But you've got to get the correct legal name. You've got to get the sex right, and you also want to get the birth date. That's very important. As we all know, celebrities love to play vanity with their birth date, drop a few years so they're a little bit younger. They'll always say, well, she was born in 1962 or in the early 60s, something like that. Locate the birth date. It's critical. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I've got a story about that. Remember 4 years ago when Woof Woof Arsenio was at his peak? Okay, and I went on the Paramount Studios tour. Because this is frequently how I develop a lot of leads. You go on studio tours. I'm not talking Universal. Universal, they don't let you get near anything anyway. That's amusement park, okay? I'm talking about if you want to be able to develop data on celebrities and see them where they're working and where things will be available, you go to the Warner Brothers studio tour. You can even go eat in the commissary after the tour. You go on the Paramount studio tour. You go to 20th Century Fox and maybe see a show taping. But it's Paramount, Warner Brothers, NBC, and Burbank. Very good tours to go on. 4 years ago, I took the Paramount tour. Arsenio was at his peak. Out on the side where they used to have his studio and everything was his car. Now, I didn't know it was his car for sure, but I asked the security guard and said, wow, man, because it was some real expensive. I think it was a BMW convertible. It was nice. I know it's more than I can afford. But in any case, I said, whose car is that? He said, oh, it's Arsenio Hall. And I said, oh, really? Well, out came my little notebook and little pen, and I wrote down that license plate number and had it run. Boom. Yeah, it was Arsenio Hall's car. Now, just to show you where you can take that, I got a copy of the registration. But then I got a copy of the title, so I can see the bank Arsenio owes to buy that car. Because vehicle titles, have to be on file in the courthouse because that's a legal record that it's a chattel mortgage. That's all public record. So there you go. So one little thread allowed me to penetrate the veil of secrecy around Arsenio Hall. Okay? Now, he made a good point. All celebrities start out as ordinary people like you and I, and then something happens where they make it big. When they are ordinary people, they don't have the phalanx of security and public relations to shield their image. So he made a very good point. You want to try to go back. If you know that Michael Keaton came from a little town in Iowa, which I'm not sure, I think he's from Pennsylvania, then you go back and get records from that little town in Iowa, like the newspaper, or write to his school and say you're doing a profile, whatever. Then you're going to find out where he may have lived in that city, what his real name was, when he was born. You'll get those primary identifiers. But I can't overstress the fact, before you move to the next phase of doing an investigation on a celebrity or a politician or anyone in the public eye, you must absolutely get the base identifiers correctly confirmed. Because if you don't have the base identifiers, it's kind of like if you know somebody's name is Jerry but it's spelled with a J, but you're looking in a database with a G, you're not going to find them. So it's very crucial. Yes?
Wait, which one did you want me to send
us? Here, come over now.
Going back to license plate and everything also, I think the safety of that is requiring you to show ID and...
Okay, I'll explain how we get around that. I'll explain how we get around that in a few minutes.
Come on, isn't that what you got?
That's what you guys are all about, getting around obstacles? I mean, come on. In any case, I wouldn't be up here talking if I didn't know how to get around a few obstacles.
The reason for it was that if something happened to that person, they would also check to see who was checking on them, and they would get a
decision. Yeah, put that one up first.
Okay, the first thing on this, a lot of states, and in fact next year on motor vehicle records, can you cover that until I'm ready to show it and everything? First of all, next year there will be something called the Driver Privacy Protection Act. It's a federal law. It takes effect next year. This law was supposed to prevent the tragedy that happened to actress Rebecca Schaefer, where the crazy guy bought her license from the state of California to find out her street address. This happened in 1989. Then he showed up and shot her. Okay, remember she was on a show with Pam Dauber. And that was the impetus in California to where in California you only have to provide a mailing address when you get a license, and they will not release license data to an individual requester until they first notify the person whose file is being requested. However, there are loopholes in that law and in the Driver Privacy Protection Act. One of them is if the request comes from a licensed information brokerage or from a private investigator, then there is no requirement. And also there is a media exception as well. So the fact is that the law has many loopholes. Very frequently, and I'll get to this later, on privacy laws, kind of like the Bank Secrecy Act that was passed back in the 70s. Supposedly, that makes our transactions at the bank private. In reality, it's a misnomer. What the Bank Secrecy Act does is legally codify the fact that you have no expectation of privacy whatsoever in any transaction you make at a U.S. bank. That is the legal. I don't care what the tellers do by keeping us away from each other at the bank and all the hushed tones. The reality is, when you make a transaction at a U.S. bank, the Supreme Court has said, because of the Bank Secrecy Act, you have no legal expectation of privacy when you conduct a transaction. So that is the thing to remember, is frequently privacy laws, when they're enacted, and I'll talk about the Privacy Act of 1974, have very little teeth because the law enforcement agencies have them gutted. In any case, let's put up the first display. Now, this is the actress who made the tearjerker I told you about, Deborah Raffin. Now, at first when I was going to put this up, I was thinking, you know, I should blot out part of her SS number because I know a few of you guys out there can make this woman's life absolute hell. But then I said, you know what, I don't believe in censorship, so I can't be censoring you guys. So I'm going to ask you guys, as gentlemen and gentlewomen, to please be stand up. Don't screw this woman over. Okay, she's just an actress. She hasn't screwed anybody, whatever. This is called, okay? Well, all right. I stepped into that one. Yeah, all right. I walked into that one. Okay, I got to admit that. Okay. Okay. Now, let me explain what we're seeing here. What this is called is an address update search report. Now, you know, you've all seen Oprah and Sally, Jesse, Raphael, where the people say, today we're going to find long-lost loved ones or long-lost friends. And then the private detective will walk out and give these people a card, and they'll say, write down what you know. And then at the end of the hour, the Oprah will say, so, do we have a match? And she'll go, yes. And then the people go, my gosh, how did you find them? I've been looking for them for 20 years. Like they have some magic recipe. And these guys charge a lot of money for what they do. Well, I'm going to show you that they don't really do anything magically. In 1989, the Bush administration destroyed everybody's privacy by saying that the top part of a credit report is not privacy protected, the so-called header data. It's called header because it's at the head of the page. Header data will contain things like name, full name, birth date, social security number, employer, number of dependents. Sometimes even contain salary information. They said the only thing that's protected on a credit report is the actual credit history.
So very quickly, the credit bureaus realized they could make millions of dollars a year by selling what are called identification or information reports, because they can now sell the header data to anybody. So basically, that meant that everybody's social security number, or at least everybody who has credit, is now a public record item. One of the searches the credit bureaus sell is what's called an address update search. If you can locate a previous address within the last 10 years, it'll vary on some systems, it can be shorter on some, longer on others, then you can find out the person's current address, social security number, and birthday. Now, with Deborah Raffin, I consulted a celebrity directory that gives mailing addresses of celebrities. Now, she happens to have an office right next to her house. So they gave the address as 9630 Eden Place in Beverly Hills. Obviously, this woman is doing pretty good because she lives in Beverly Hills. Okay. From that, I said that what I need to do now is run an address update search, because if she has ever used that address to apply for credit, then it's going to give me a link to her current address if that one is no longer current, and it's also going to give me other identifiers on her, like her social security number. So as you can see, they run these through two bureaus. I think the top one is TransUnion, which gives that crap on an address update. The second one, I think, is a TRW. First one didn't get anything. Second one, look what happens. The stuff at the top in the left-hand corner is what the operator inputs, what I gave her. Look what we get back. Raffin, Deborah I. We get back her social security number. Then we get her current address, 301 North Cannon Drive. Now, that's her mailing address that she uses. That's actually a mail forwarding service. A lot of celebrities use a mail forwarding service as their address that they get their mail and their bills and whatever else. In any case, now, if we look below that, though, it says previous address, 2630 Eden Place, Beverly Hills, California. Now, that's where she actually lives at. What happened was, the last time she applied for credit, she used a mailing address, or she contacted her creditors and said, from now on, don't send the bills to where I live, send them to my mailing address. So when the creditor sends in his magnetic tapes each month to the bureau, he's sending in that address now. Okay? Now, you also notice there's a date reported. That date is usually the first date that that particular address was reported into the credit bureau, okay, for that given individual. So I think that one there is that 794. I can't quite make it up from here. One on top, I think it's got a 95. So we know that that is the date that she actually got those addresses into the system. So let's look at what we've been able to learn. From me just watching a B-grade movie of the week tearjerker, I now have the lead actress's full name, her address, her social security number, and even a second address that she uses. All just from watching television. Isn't TV amazing? Yeah.
What's the 800 number?
Where? Oh, okay. Okay, I'll talk about that a little bit later. You will be surprised at who is getting involved in the information brokerage business. And in this case, it's your friendly local public library. Okay. Are there any other questions on this in particular? Okay. Let me go on to the next. Jeff, can I get to... Okay, what is it? With address update? Okay. Let's see here. Okay, put 3 on and then 4 on. Put 3 on first. Okay, now, we got her social security number from the address update. And that gave us her current address, but we want to know more because we're all data hounds here. I want to know, where has this woman lived since Jump Street? Well, the bureaus also sell what's known as a social security trace. All you need is a social security number. And this is why I caution you on, you should never put social security numbers on checks or whatever. Because with just an SS number, you can go through all three bureaus, and you'll see it'll say SS social security number at the top. That's her number. Then this is one search that was done. It puts in every address and the name of every individual who has used that social security number. To give you an interesting aside on this, the current Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been enduring a minor scandal in Israel because his social security number has three other people who are using it. Because what happened is, sometimes people with bad credit figure, they'll just change a digit on their SS number and apply for new credit, but they change the digit to a number somebody already has. So Benjamin Netanyahu's social security number is also being used by, I think, an Eric Sullivan and an Eric Sullivan Jr. So this is what can happen. In any case, as we can see on this first one, I think this is TransUnion, the first one at the top, it gives her name. We have the North Cannon Drive address. Then we have an Eaton Place address. Then it gives us a secondary file as well. And it gives us older addresses in Florida and in Ventura County. Now, you'll notice there's something called a hawk alert down there at the bottom. It says current address is a check cashing service. In the old days, people who committed massive credit card fraud would go and rent a P.O. box, not a P.O. box, but rent like mailboxes, et cetera, and then apply for 200 cards or whatever in different names, charge them up to the limit, and then disappear. Well, the credit bureaus became wise to the fact that these people were using accommodation addresses. So what happens is every year the three bureaus go through and scan into their databases the addresses, telephone numbers, and other identifiers of every check cashing service and like mail forwarding service in the country. That goes into their database. When somebody applies for credit with an address or a phone number, if the address or phone number matches an address of one of these services or of a telephone answering service, then a hawk alert. And the other credit bureaus have different names for them, but they're all the same thing, will flash on the report saying this address is not a real residence address. Now, what does this tell us, though, doing an investigation? It tells us we definitely know if we're going to create a map of where the celebrities really live, not to send them to 201 North Cannon Drive, because we know that's a check cashing service. We do find out, however, that 2630 Eaton Place is probably where she actually lives. We also find out all of her other addresses where she's lived. Now, odds are she has records that she's created in those other states, in Florida and in Ventura County, California. Now, the second search wasn't as good. I think the second one might have been TRW. Sometimes they're pretty crappy. All that gave us was the current address. However, let's go to the next page. Sorry, I missed that. Thank you for getting to that. She got married to a movie producer named Michael Viner a couple of years ago. She changed her name to Deborah Rathen Viner. Credit bureau computers are very, very good. And what they do is that if you change your name and you're using the same address and SS number or the same SS number, they will link the old file into the new one. Because they're trying to, one of the things, ways that credit bureaus sell their services is they say, we can get more negative data on an individual than you ever could on your own. This is one of the ways they do it. Their computer is programmed to find any possible matches. This is also important because, as I told you before, if you can find an old address on a celebrity, then the credit bureau's computer will link that old address to a current address. So you can use that to find out where they are now, even if the old address was 10 years old. So let's go to the next one, Jeff, and then we'll see. The next one was a true gold mine. Now we've got all of her addresses. We know more about where this woman has lived than maybe her kids do. Okay? Now, I think this is CBI Equifax. I'm not quite sure. But on the right-hand corner, you'll see it says, who's her employer? Dove Audio. Dove Audio are the people who do audiobooks of bestsellers, whatever, and she does a lot of those every year. Now, she's smart because she realized listing herself as self-employed, which she did in 1991. You see the one at the bottom, it says E. E stands for employer, and it says self, and then the RPTD means reported. When was this reported? So this was reported on 8 of 91, okay? But she probably realized it's easier from terms of establishing credit and getting bank loans to have an actual employer. So now she lists Dove Audio as her employer. This is frequently what people who act, who aren't top flight, shall we say, A-list do, is that they will list their production company, which won't carry their name, as their employer, so it's easier for them to qualify for loans or mortgages or whatever else. So in any case, we now know where she earns a living. We know she works at Dove Audio. So that's another nugget. We now know her year of birth. She was born in 1953. So we know she's 43. And I'll tell you, she looks pretty good for a 43-year-old. Okay? We now see the first initial of her spouse, which is an M. One of the ways credit bureau computers distinguish you from another person is if you're married. If you're married, on the header of your credit report, the first initial of your spouse will come on if you have ever applied for credit jointly. Okay? So her spouse's name is Michael Viner. Now, I could have just as easily then run his name through with the address, an address update first to get the SS number, and then done this on him too. Okay? Now, as we can see, we have all of the addresses that have ever been reported on her credit report. Some of these get on there when you apply for credit. Others get on there when a creditor pulls a bureau on you to review an account that you already have. A lot of credit card companies do that. Every couple of years, they'll pull a bureau to make sure that you're not going nuts on all your other accounts and that they're going to be the next one that you're going to default on. So now we know that this woman lives in Studio City, West Palm Beach. Like I said, she's doing pretty good because these are not cheap places to live. Orlando, Beverly Hills, we now know every place she's lived going back, at least 10 years. Now, we know that she lives in Beverly Hills. Wouldn't it be kind of nice to know how much that house is worth? And maybe what the income level is. I mean, you know, you drive down Rodeo Drive, you see all those people, I kind of wonder. Well, we found that out. Thank you, my good man. Okay, this is what's called a household profile. Household profile uses census data, property tax records, and credit bureau header data to put together a very accurate profile of the owner and of the likely status of that person in a house. We see that in her neighborhood, first of all, the actual address she lives at is 2633 Eden Place. 2630 is an annex they built onto their house for her office. Okay? Now, if we look at the demographic section, we see that the average income in this neighborhood is $202,500. That's a nice neighborhood. We see that the median home value is $500,000, meaning that half of the homes have a value over that, the other half have a value under that. In that census tract, now a census tract is a small tract, it's like 50 houses. So this tells us basically her home is probably worth right around $500,000 because it's a very small tract that they use. Okay, now it says percentage of owner-occupied households is 98%. Very few people rent in Beverly Hills. In any case, so the thing is, then we get her four nearby neighbors. And she has some interesting neighbors. Norman Cousins, Rudolph Winkler, lots of heavy hitter kind of guys in the entertainment industry. Now, if you were interested, you could then run these guys through the same search we've just done to get all this information on them. The point is, for all this data that we've done, we've just started the tip of the iceberg. If we wanted to know more, we could then run a civil court judgment search on her, which would tell us, has she ever been divorced? Does she have any tax liens? Has she ever had any tax liens? Has she ever been sued? We could then get her voter registration records. Voter registration records are an unknown source of very accurate address information on celebrities and politicians, because you can't use a mailing service legally anyway to register to vote. Now, you and I could get away with that, but if you're Sylvester Stallone, you can't use mailboxes, etc., as your address to vote, because the media is going to find out. Voter registration records are public record documents in almost every state. And you can go and review them at will. Now, the nice thing is in 30 states, later this year, voter registration records will be available on computer from a number of information brokers. So you can just search the records on computer and find them. Voter registration records can be given to some states, get the SS number and the birth date when you register to vote, along with driver's license number and other things. So they can be a very good source of information. The point is, what I'm saying here is, I just saw this woman one time in a tearjerker movie of the week. And yes, everything worked out for the best, you might like to know. But from that, we now have her whole life history, or the beginnings of it. We now know more about her than a lot of her friends do. Okay? This is available because of the erosion of privacy that's happened, because so many databases now have been computerized. Let me take a couple of questions and I'll go on. Yeah. Okay. Good question. The beauty is, a lot of businesses now are getting into becoming information brokers. This particular search I did through the LA County Public Library. They run a service called FYI that's a fee-based service. They will do social security searches, address update searches, everything else on a pay-as-you-go basis. A social security search from them for all three bureaus is only $30. An address update search is $30. Household profile is $15. You don't have to subscribe to use them. Now, they don't do certain searches, like they don't have any motor vehicle databases. For motor vehicle databases, generally you're better off being online with a particular service, because then you can go at will, and it's less expensive. But these are more accessible to people now. Now, in the book, How to Investigate Your Friends, Enemies, and Lovers, I talk about exactly the question you asked about how you can get in contact with these services, what they charge, and how you can actually make money by doing searches. Because as we see now, all the people did on that Oprah show was, if the people knew the guy's social security number they were looking for, they just ran an SS trace and said, here's his address. That's all that they did. Okay, some searches you can now do at home because the software is real cheap, like foam disk or foam file. You can buy those and be able to do your own telephone searches on your own, because on those programs you can search with just a number. Some of them have crisscross enhancement, so you can search by address, everything else. So a lot of these things are becoming more available. This book details, and this is a pre-publication proof, the actual book looks different than this. However, we wanted to have something to show you. And if you're interested, if you buy the pre-publication proof, if you later then buy the book, which will be out in about a month, Index will ship you the book for free. In any case, I talk about all the various ways of doing cost-effective searches and how you can actually make money doing searches for other people. Yeah?
Two questions. How much for the pre-proof? And when you walk into the library, do they want to know who you are? They just have to.
Yeah, no, they don't care who you are. If you use FYI to do searches, they don't care who you are. You just walk in, and like, green is the universal currency of everything. And the pre-publication proof, I don't know how much this is. You need to go by the index table on your way out. Sue will be more than happy to give you the good information on that. Yeah. Are they? Okay, well, if you order them today, they will ship them out to you next week. Yeah. It's available. The problem is, if you do this on a private individual and then you would put this out in public like this, then you can be sued. Yes, it is available. It's available on anybody. If somebody, this is what I'm going to talk to you now as I segue into privacy power. The point is, if you give somebody your name and address, you've given them the ability to do this to you. See? Even though you're just a private individual. Yeah.
Can you address two questions? And maybe if you have knowledge of New York State, you could be New York specific.
Okay. And then they sublet it out.
If you give it up, the rent goes up 20%.
Right, yeah.
The renter does not have a phone number in his name. And these are two phone number questions.
So I wanted to find this person. I gave an investigator name and address. He checked some sort of junk mail database.
Okay.
Social. Couldn't come up with a number. Now, the thing is, how do you work with that? And number two state, in New York State, with 9X or Bell Atlantic, how do you find non-published numbers?
Okay, you need to get non-published, non-listed numbers. That's when you're best to try to go through a private eye, as you did. Because if I don't have any way, for example, like with Oprah Winfrey. I got Oprah Winfrey's number. How did I get it? Because I knew her address. I knew she lived in a water tower building. I got her address, then I went right. Then I went backwards from there. If you've got an address, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. It depends if the number shows up on a crisscross directory. Okay, then if you go to, like, if you would go to FYI, they may very well be able to get you the address.
I've checked FYI. They do not, 9X keeps their unpublished or whatever you call numbers very, very secure. The 411 operators just get a tag saying it's not.
Okay, then the only other thing I can say is that there's one thing that detectives frequently will do, and what they'll do is that if they can get a mailing address of somebody close to the person, okay, then what they'll do is they'll send a piece of mail that's saying you have won blah blah blah, or you need to call, and it's an 800 number. Person called the 800 number, boom. Okay, that's the thing that can be difficult. Overall, New York actually has very good access though to most files, like driving records. Yeah, I mean, the thing is with this is that there's no absolutes that will work all of the time. However, with most people, you're able to. The other thing you can try to do is do what's called an asset search, where they will look for real assets and chattel assets in the individual's name. That can get to be expensive, but a lot of times if you can't locate anybody any other way, then you can locate them that way. And never overlook the voter registration records. If the person registers to vote, a lot of times because they're told they have to put their actual address on there, they do provide it. Let's see, who's been waiting a while here? How are you?
How do you get something like, you mentioned civil court records. How about criminal, like felony?
Okay, criminal court records come under a number of ways. You can always go county by county and get them. About 10 states will allow you to get to access their central database, and you can get statewide criminal record information. And I talk about what those states are and how to write them in here. The only thing with criminal records is that if you're going to search for somebody who has a criminal record, say in Seattle's in King County. You don't just want to search King County. You want to search Pierce County to the south, and I forget the name of the county to the north, but you want to search the counties around King County, because he could have been in Tacoma and had a DUI, or been just over the line in Pierce County someplace and had something happen. Criminal records vary greatly state by state. However, this is one way you can find out if a person has a serious record. We all know about the Brady Bill to buy handguns. And the Brady Bill only works because when you try to buy a gun under the Brady Bill, they have access to something called the Interstate Identification Index, or III, run by the FBI. Now, I talked about this a little bit last year, but I'll just recap it quickly. Criminal records are created at the federal level in federal court, and they're created at the state level and then in local courthouses. The FBI, for years, has wanted to be able to create a system where they could check one database to see if a person likely had a criminal record. The problem was getting timely assemblage of all of these documents and into one database. The Interstate Identification Index is an attempt to do just that. On a regular basis, states forward criminal conviction records of people in their jurisdictions to the FBI, along with the federal courts doing the same thing. This is not the warrant file of people that are wanted for arrest. This is people that have criminal records. Then what the FBI does is they then enter this information into III for the Interstate Identification Index. When a person applies to buy a gun under the Brady Bill and the local sheriff or local police department checks the person out, the first thing they check out is the state's own computer database of everybody who's been convicted of crimes in that state. Okay? They check that first. Then they hit another menu button and they check. They go to NCIC, which is the National Crime Information Center, and then they go to the menu that allows them into III, into the Interstate Identification Index. Then that name, birth date, and SS number is run against III, and then III will say, is there a likely match? If there is, they then try to confirm other identifiers, and then they see if this guy does match, what has he been convicted of? That's one way. If the person can qualify to buy a gun under the Brady Bill, there's a good chance they don't have a serious criminal record. Okay, I'll do you again.
What's the difference between
III
and NCIC?
NCIC is the center, is the institution, for lack of a better word, that all of these computers are housed within. National Crime Information Center. It's a clearinghouse. So a local police officer gets a warrant for you for DUI. You got your license plate, but you drove off, whatever. He enters that warrant. When he enters that warrant into his system, it also gets put on NCIC. If a warrant is extraditable, it has to go on NCIC. So in other words, if you've got a warrant in Seattle for unpaid parking tickets, you're not going to get busted on an NCIC check. Okay? So NCIC, the computer itself, has numerous files. Like there's wanted persons, missing persons, stolen vehicles. There's the III files. Okay? It's numerous sets of massive databases that the police can use to find things out. Because if a car is stolen in Nevada today, it might be in Oregon tomorrow. So that information has to be available. Yes? Right, exactly. Okay, that's a very good idea. Yes, you know that. The credit bureau. Not on this type of search. Okay, because technically this is public record. Credit Bureau does not record this as an inquiry because you're not pulling the actual credit history. Okay? So she'll have no knowledge, unless you guys do something to her, that this ever that we all have looked at her social security number and birth date, okay? Yeah, you, and then I'm gonna move to the next. You mean the credit bureaus? The credit bureaus compile a list of mail forwarding services. Generally, they do it when the phone books come out. As the new phone books come out, then they'll go through and scan in the listings. And then like here in Las Vegas, it comes out twice a year. So, yeah, that's what they do. Yeah. Oh, okay. Starts using it. Happens all the time. Here's what happens. The credit bureau computer recognizes, the first person in the system with the number, it belongs to them. So if you use the number, if it's your number, you apply for credit, whatever. That's fine. 3 years later, this guy here with bad credit decides he'll change one digit. He makes your number up. When he applies for credit, what's going to happen is it's going to say, Hawk alert, attention, file variation, SS number belongs to, and then it'll give your name already in the system. If he's not in the credit bureau system, then it's going that the credit bureau will forever say that is your number. Okay.
Is all they do is check the algorithm and make sure that the algorithm matches?
Okay, good question. I'm about to get to that. Jeff, On the back of one of those sheets, I have the ones that the paper. Oh, that's right. You got to.
Yeah.
How long does that take? Or should I just talk?
Yeah, just read them off.
Okay. Let's talk about Social Security numbers, because this will get me in the privacy power. Okay, we don't have a national identity card. Well, but we do. We all know we do. It's called a Social Security number. Let's talk about this. In 1935, when Social Security was introduced, there was a great debate and furor over the fact that for the first time, every individual American would have a piece of identification from the federal government. Before that time, you didn't. Most people didn't. Unless you had a passport or in the military, most Americans would never have a piece of federally issued identification. The worry that careful that you don't accidentally do something out of habit to then re-cause a connection, like getting a Victoria's Secret catalog sent to your house, because guess what? They sell their mailing list. Okay, so you have to really be careful. And then they enhance it with voter registration records and other things to get other identifiers. Okay? So this is the thing. Now the other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly is a lot of people have credit problems, that kind of stuff. I've written a book called Credit Power. It talks about how to use the Fair Credit Reporting Act to deal with problems of bad credit, collection agencies, how to start a new credit file, everything else. Like I said, this is a pre-publication proof, but the book itself should be out in a couple of months. If you buy the pre-pub proof, if you buy the book later, Index will send it to you for and pay the shipping cost, okay? It's a very good book. It covers a lot of problems, a lot of people have faced. It also shows how not to get your credit screwed up in the first place. Like if you don't have credit, don't go around, keep applying for credit cards after you get turned down, because then you're just going to get a bunch of rejections, okay? And this has the latest things to reflect the changes in the laws and the systems that happened late last year. Okay. Finally, there's a little book here. This isn't one of mine, but I just want to talk about this, called Mother's Maiden Name. This is a book on how to find out somebody's mother's maiden name through a number of methods. And this is a, I don't know, I can't see any good reason that the purpose, the info in this book can serve, because if you know somebody's mother's maiden name, that's a password on a lot of things. After you read this book, you'll think twice about using your mother's maiden name as your password. Okay? Yeah. The smart man. No, no. You have to realize the biggest source of personal information, it's not the computer, it's not the talky person next door, and it's not a monkey. It's you. Somebody says to you, "What is this?" And you say, "This is what it is." You don't say, "Wait a minute, why do you need that to give me cable service?" Learn to ask that question. Yes.
Yeah. What about the differences between privacy regulation in the United States and the differences in comparison to what's happening in Europe? So there's a lot tighter regulation in terms of data collection.
Well, I'll just say this, because I know Canada well. Canada has the equivalent of a social security number. It's called social insurance number. However, it doesn't appear on driver's licenses. It's not used as the big file linking tool it is here. So you don't have to use this to create record systems. It's only because in the United States, law enforcement and the ID bureaucracy decided they wanted an ID card, a national ID by stealth. Other countries, I can't really comment on. Yeah. Oh, I agree. I agree. That's what I call knee-jerk republicanism. Knee-jerk republicanism is saying is that, for example, lots of children don't get their child support. So instead of targeting those people who owe child support, what they say is, well, there should be a national database of all people who owe child support. And every time you go get a job, we'll check your name and number against this database. In other words, Republicans, and I don't know, Clinton seems to believe it too, believe in security through database creation and data matching. Problem is, if you have one error per 1,000 records, now if you're checking 1,000 records, that's only one error. 100,000 records, 100 errors. Million records, 1,000 people whose wages you may garnish, deny employment, or falsely arrest because you decided you were going to try to create a massive database and check tens of millions of people against it constantly because they didn't pay their child support. This is the danger, is that we now, for example, if you apply for a job with the federal government, they check to see, do you have unpaid taxes? Do you have unpaid child support? Already they do that. And every year, you don't see these people, but there are hundreds of people who falsely have their wages garnished or denied employment, denied places to live because huge data matching programs are done and they're falsely identified as being people who haven't upheld their obligation. And this is a real danger. But people want to say, the Republicans basically, and this is my political viewpoint A, their attitude is, if there's crime, we solve it by reducing your privacy. Like the Communications Decency Act, hey, we don't want young children getting porn over the internet, so we're going to make it a crime to supply it, whatever, and basically turn the internet into a place that's totally unusable. And even the judges at the federal appellate court realized this was not possible to do. It would be analogous to saying, well, because I could call up a 10-year-old girl on the phone and say lewd things to her, that every telephone has to have some way of recording what was said, and then that should be vetted by some agency. You know, I mean, it's the same kind of baloney. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the same kind of baloney. So there's only two other things I want to get to, and then because my time is short. First of all, I want to talk about Index for a minute. Index is a First Amendment publisher. They publish a lot of my stuff. They publish a lot of other very good stuff, as you guys know. They deserve your support because they are going to be the company that will be there with quality information that's presented in good format and done in a quality way for you guys to communicate and get the information you need. They have a website. I think I have the... Can this, will this go on the thing? They have a website. electricity.com/IPGbooks. I appreciate if you guys would please patronize them. They are here for you. They deserve your support. They also deserve not to have their system screwed with. Because, look, I don't get paid anymore for saying this, and if it wasn't true, I wouldn't say it. I'm a writer. I'm a good writer. I can go any place I want to with a book. I choose to go with Index. They're trying to bring quality to the books that are of interest to people like you and other things that are unpopular. For example, I've got a couple of books here. You guys are here in Vegas. Dustin D. Marks was a card sharp here and a crossroader. I know this guy. He took the casinos off in this town for probably nearly $1 million. Okay? They would go in and go to a blackjack table and leave with 50, 60 grand, he and his crew would. Okay, he's written an excellent book called Cheating at Blackjack. He shows how the casinos can be beat. The casinos, you know, they sell books on how to play their games and whatever down in the gift shop. You don't see this book down there. There's a reason you don't see this book down there. Okay? This is an excellent book. This is a book who's got the credentials that you guys at DEF CON respect. He's been there and done that. Okay? He really has. I would urge you guys, if you guys are interested in how card counting is done, how somebody could take the casinos off at their own game, I suggest you get a copy of this book. This is an excellent book. He also follows it up with a second one called Cheating at Blackjack Squared. In this book, he actually shows you the moves. Now, this is a little more technical, but here he actually shows you the moves that they actually did to do what they did in this book. These are great books. Okay? All I'm saying is that patronize them. Because if you don't patronize them, then you may find that there'll come a time where there aren't publishers who are willing to publish unpopular material, take legal flack, so that we can keep information available to everyone. Because I don't believe in censorship, you don't. Now what you do with information, that's different. But the information should be available to anyone. And once again, please, I beg you, don't screw Deborah Rappin's life up, okay? All right, she's kind of cute. And it was a great tearjerker, okay? So don't screw up. I want to see more movies of the week, okay? Look, I love talking to you guys today. If you guys want to talk to me after, I'll be at the Index table.